Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast, episode 256. And we're just going to dive right in.
Yep, let's do it.
We got a bunch of news. We got to talk about
some weird trailers.
We're going to talk about weird trailers. We're going to talk about Detective Pikachu, which we all saw.
Yep, which currently Detective Pikachu is owning in our store poll.
Yeah.
Which is, as always, was a very carefully thought of and crafted notion. We really wanted to get inside the psyche of our customers by asking, who is more deserving of the Iron Throne, Detective Pikachu or Sonic the Hedgehog?
And it turns out Detective Pikachu.
Yeah. You know what? I feel like people recognize, they looked at that and they thought, they probably turned it over for a while, and I'm betting talked it over with friends and family.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to just jump in on that.
Is it possible they were just horrified by the visage of Sonic the Hedgehog and his human teeth?
No, this was the real one, but they may still be in dealing with PTSD.
Yes, I think that is completely
But
possible.
I think they probably thought, Sonic is rash and impulsive, and although a hero, he might jump into situations, and whereas Detective Pikachu is thoughtful and he's a guy who's more concerned with facts.
Yeah, that makes sense.
He's probably an intellectual between the two of them.
It's a good argument.
And also addicted to coffee, which is a lot of people are, so they can kind of...
They can relate to him. He's the king that you could sit down and have a cup of coffee with.
Yes. Did we all vote for Pikachu? Yes.
I mean, I'm going to. I need to.
Nick, it's your responsibility to vote.
If you said that this was Detective Pikachu versus Knuckles, I think Knuckles fits in more with the Game of Thrones world and could probably...
Or isn't there there's a Dark Sonic, right?
I think that's Knuckles, isn't it?
No, I think he's actually called Dark Sonic or something.
Is it?
Or Shadow? Is that it?
Shadow Sonic?
I think just Shadow.
Here's what I know about Sonic. He's a hedgehog. He's blue. He spins really fast, and he sometimes makes beepy noises.
There's rings?
There's rings.
Yeah.
You know Tails? Everybody knows Tails.
If anybody can...
What is Tails?
Tails is a sidekick. The guy, the little fox-looking creature that has like a...
If anybody can delineate kind of in like a single paragraph the basic gist of Sonic, please send it to us with the subject line, Sonic Explanation.
Yeah, there you go. All right.
Please send in.
So, we got some game nights coming up. This Sunday, the Round Rock Board Games Meetup will be here from about 2 o'clock on. These guys are a good bunch of guys. They play a bunch of sort of Euro games and that kind of thing. So if you want to play board games, we ask about board game meetups all the time. That is one that is going on like basically every other Sunday.
Yep. And they just dive right in. They're like, I think many of them are pretty regular players.
Yeah.
But they also... you know, it's sort of a learn by doing, you know, if they haven't played a game, I get the impression they just jump right in and they're like, let's see what it is, and they don't dawdle too much, and they can knock a game out in an hour or two.
I like that style.
Yep.
Then we have our Easy Tiger game night coming up on Tuesday, May 28th. That'll be Easy Tiger with the Link. I'll bring a bunch of games out there, and we'll play games there, so that's another good possibility for board games. And then finally, International Tabletop Day, which is going to be Saturday, June 1st. We're going to teach some games, we'll have open game board games, and we're going to be giving away a lot of our promos that we have. So we've got promos for 40 different games.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet promos.
And so you can go online, look at the list of promos we're giving away. We've got that on our website. But come in, get a bunch of promos, play some board games, it'll be fun. And also we're doing a sale on board games that day.
Nice.
Then we have Modern Horizons pre-release for Magic on Sunday, June 9th. We have Free RPG Day coming on Saturday, June 15th. We also have... There'll be 6 different games running that day, usually indie RPGs. There's a Kids on Bike. There's an Altered Carbon that's run on Fate. There's Monster Hearts, which is sort of a Buffy-style kind of game. Right.
And I assume, I don't know if we've talked about it before, but Kids on Bikes is in the style of Goonies, Stranger Things, and all that stuff.
If you want to come out and play some games, you can email us and sign up for one of those games. You can find all the info on our website.
I like running some games like that that are a little bit more off the beaten path.
Yep.
It can't all be D&D people.
Yeah, although D&D does have a game that day as well.
No.
And then we'll also be at Great Arson Comic Con that weekend, repping Larry Hama and the store. And we are still selling the tickets. They've gone up to $35 for now. They'll probably go up again before the end of it, but...
in other words, the quicker people get them, better the price.
That's right. Support your local Comic-Con. All right. On to news. So, Stumptown with Kobe Smulders, a.k.a. Maria Hill.
Yeah.
This is based on Greg Rucka's comic.
Based on Greg Rucka's, detective graphic novels, is going to series at ABC. They actually greenlit it.
Really? So. Yeah, which I thought was really cool. Guess the pilot was great. People liked it, and they were like, make more.
Who draws the Stumptown?
Matthew Soworth drew the first one. They changed artists since.
Oh, okay. Is that only in hardcover?
No, it's in trade now.
It's actually one of their $9.99 trades.
Okay, I need to check that out. I sometimes, just as with Brubaker, his brother-in-arms back on Gotham Central, I got to kind of be in the mood for Rucka.
Yeah.
It can be a little dry, but it also can be great, and sometimes it's great and dry.
Here's the thing. I liked Stumptown, but didn't love it, but I think it's going to work great as a TV show.
You think that actors will bring something to it?
I think Kobe Smulders in particular is going to be perfect to bring something to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
So I'm pretty excited about this. They also announced, we're getting some of the TV news right now, so they also announced that The Orville has been renewed for season 3.
Yep. Which I still need to watch season 2, but I've heard almost nothing but good things about it, except from people who hate the show, in which case they're not particularly getting on board.
I was a late adopter, but I have to watch, I think, the last few episodes of season 2, but season 2 was better than season 1.
So. Yeah.
Agreed. I've caught up, and I actually really love it.
Cool.
I think the last
You've mentioned
really
a few
strong.
Episodes, Randy, where you were like, that was a great episode, and like... That's pretty notable to be able to say.
Season 2, they actually do a couple of two-parters.
Oh.
That, typically they were just kind of done in one stories, but they've brought some more continuity to it.
They definitely did some big sort of world-building type stuff, too, and they've definitely changed up some stuff.
That's pretty cool.
They particularly explore a lot of stuff with Isaac's people and with the Mocklins.
Yeah. And then I think they're going to further kind of go into the story because they're launching a comic.
Yeah.
Which I'm excited for. And Heroclix.
The Heroclix is a pretty funny idea. I'm especially amused that because they have done Star Trek ones, you could literally have Star Trek versus them if you want.
In TV or in movie news, we don't usually talk about stuff in development, but this is all fun stuff I want to talk about. So Universal is exploring the possibility of doing a Fast and Furious spinoff featuring Cypher.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Charlize Theron.
Charlize Theron's character, which... Isn't she, like, one of the worst bad guys they had? Didn't she murder a baby?
She didn't murder a baby.
She ordered a baby murdered.
They held a baby as leverage.
They killed
the mom in front of a baby.
Yes.
Messed up.
Yeah, they're very evil in this comic book world. That's a pretty evil thing to do.
But if you envision that the Charlize Theron will be kind of like a Suicide Squad where she's running her own sort of
Nick makes a good ridiculous case for it.
I think it would be kind of amazing if you had two sort of separate squads.
And you know, honestly, in as testosterone fueled as this has been, and I think would continue to be, honestly, with her, it would just be like femtosterone or something.
Oh, man. I'm in camp. See everything Charlize Theron does because she's just has fun with her roles.
Oh man, Charlize Theron has made way too many bad movies for me to be in that camp.
I think I just like her.
She is always talented.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing is that she has done, like, she was a fun villainess in that, like, I wasn't, like, so in love with her villain that I'd, like, for sure want to see more of it, but I could see it working out.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I've seen her give Oscar-worthy performances, and I think I'd probably prefer she do that.
Who's the other hacker in Fast and the Furious? What's her name?
With the hair?
Yeah. Anyway,
I remember God's Eye, which is her creation.
Maybe she'll wind up having to work with her, and it'll be the all-women hacker squad.
I honestly think it could be an all-women Fast and Furious thing. I think I might have heard that pitched. and if it's... That sounds cool.
They definitely killed Gina Carano's character. Like, there's no question that she could magically have survived. Doesn't she get sucked into, like, a jet engine or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Like, she is definitely not back. Not like Han, who better be coming back.
Right, we just assume that will be written in at some point in the future, and it's only to their detriment that they haven't gotten around to it.
It'll be Fast and Furious 20, and it'll be Old Man Han. And like, I've been running things this whole time. Dom knew.
I'm just thinking... If Hobbs and Shaw does well, which at this point I feel like it's going to kick ass, they could use Deckard's sister in working for Cypher, maybe.
Oh my God, I don't want this. She's evil.
Hey, here's a quick question. When they... Han was in... which one? What was...
Tokyo Drift.
Yeah, Tokyo Drift.
Which number was that?
Three.
And was that meant to become its own thing?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, yeah, that was like the Fast and Furious 2 had bombed, so they decided to do a different thing to relaunch the franchise.
Was he supposed to be the main guy, or were, like...
I think he was, right?
Han was... No, he was a secondary character. He was sort of like Sensei to a young, troubled American, sort of on his last legs, coming over to...
What happened to that character?
He showed up again in Fast 7 or 8.
Okay, just one of those characters where I didn't probably know
super well who they were. He just showed up, like, for a moment. He was also, like, with Bow Wow.
Just curious.
Okay.
Formerly known as Little Bow Wow.
Sure.
Yep.
But became Big
now
Bow
Wow. Now a manly Bow Wow. Later to be just Wow. I was just trying to figure out if Han might end up being, like... If he would actually get a second shot at a leading role, if they were to bring him back and like use that as a springboard for yet another
franchise. I actually want to see the Mr. Nobody spinoff where Han has actually secretly been working for Kurt Russell.
I would very much be on board that. I think that their trick is, if they want to do their crazy Fast and Furious shared universe, is that each one does need to, like, obviously you want that kind of goofy energy of the Fast and Furious movies, but each one does need to bring something a little different to the table.
Yeah.
So a little more spy-y, a little more action-y, a little more car chase-y. Whatever it is, he's got to have a cool focus.
I can't wait for Dom to get the Infinity Gauntlet.
I'm in favor of anything Fast and Furious expanding. So.
Well, you know, when Marvel is flailing around after their next phase starts to topple a little bit, they're like, let's merge with the Fast and Furious franchise. So we'll get to Dom and the Infinity Gauntlet.
The Fast and the Furious and Fire Lord.
I've heard rumors that Keanu Reeves is joining, so...
That makes sense.
Really?
Yeah, that he's joining the Fast franchise.
That'd be a big get.
They should just do Fast and the Furious meets John Wick.
Is that bigger than, like, The Rock?
Yeah, I don't think they should combine with other franchises, because then somehow we're going to get, like, the Expendables crap in there.
The Expendables is a good idea, it was just poorly executed.
I would like to see Keanu Reeves as the bad guy, though.
I could see that.
I mean, inevitably he'll join the family or something, but if he's the bad guy, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I think he'd be a good fit. I don't quite know what role I would want to see him in. I could also see him as a uneasy ally would also be acceptable. But I think I don't want other franchises to formally be part of it.
It's just the Fast and Furious franchise that's branching off into 17 different things.
Yes.
I still want to see him in space.
I'm trying to...
Maybe he can lead that aspect of it.
Yes, he can be the space force.
Yeah.
They will be souping up space shuttles and...
What they need to have happen... Here's the way I would do it. You stealth it in a little bit, and one that starts out almost normal, but then you find out, like, whoever the bad guy of the piece is running missions for extraterrestrials, like some creepy extraterrestrials, and that's how the technology gets down there, and we start getting, like, you know, like, so that in the next movie, they're like, there's a base on the moon, you know, and stuff like that.
It sounds stupid. No aliens in Fast and the Furious.
I'm just saying, if we're gonna get there, then you can't just have moon buggies racing around.
You can have a moon bug. You have a super rich guy with a moon base. You could do that.
Okay.
Bond had all those kinds of multiple times.
That does make more sense than aliens.
Yeah, it's just logical, Dave. Speaking of fun things to speculate about, James Wan is apparently, they're moving forward on him producing a Mortal Kombat reboot.
Again, he's actually somebody I feel like is a little bit better than that. but here's the thing: done right, it could be very fun.
He probably has some love of the property, and
you know what? My sort of concern would be, because of his horror stuff, would be that they would lean into the violent side of it. When I think what I liked about the '90s movie, which remains to this day, as we've often discussed, the best video game movie ever.
Maybe. Except for possibly the game we're about to talk about.
That is like a hybrid video game.
That's true.
That was more a card game that became a video game.
I'm just saying, people are calling it a video game movie.
Yeah,
that's interesting. That's a good point. We'll get around to that. But I think he would probably be a good fit. He's done the adventure stuff now with Aquaman. And he's got horror in his blood, so you can get a little bit edgier with the violence, I think. But I think The thing that I always liked about the previous Mortal Kombat, or the original one, was that almost that it felt like a Ray Harryhausen movie combined with like Bruce Lee.
Yes. Yeah.
And I would want that to continue that sort of adventure-y thing. And I feel like if you get too gory and bloody violent with it, then I'm not going
to
have an interest.
Can we just get Christopher Lambert to come back and play Raiden? Or Raiden?
I don't know if you necessarily want that. For
I want that.
You know, James Wan, it occurs to me, he did create his, like, I don't know if he's the creator of torture porn, but he did do the first Saw movie, the good one.
Yeah.
And so if they did want to lean into the violence as the video games, I gather, I've seen, like, the last few or, like, clips of him, and I'm like, oh, that's crazy violent.
Hey, isn't Guy Pierce, wasn't he in Saw?
Or maybe somebody else. No, it's no,
Cary Elwes. Cary Elwes. They couldn't afford Guy Pierce at the time.
No.
Now they could. Now they could.
I'm wondering if Cary Elwes could be the new Raiden.
Would accept it, yeah. I feel like he's just the right level of actor.
I think the biggest question is Raiden, you said he's producing this, he's not directing it, right?
Right.
I was going to say, if he was directing it, Patrick Wilson would play some part.
Johnny Cage.
Yes, I can see Patrick Wilson as Johnny Cage. No, Patrick Wilson is Shao Kahn.
He only plays villains in these movies from here on out.
With, like, over the top.
No, Goro. He's going to play Goro.
No, that would be a completely CGI creature.
With his face on it. They could do that now.
Oh.
Anyway, James Wan producing Mortal Kombat could be fun.
Yes.
I can see it.
All right, last bit of speculation here, and it sounds like it's pretty much a done deal. Apparently, Michael Rooker might be playing King Shark in Suicide Squad with James Gunn.
I thought he came out and denied it.
Did he?
I thought he did.
Oh, no.
I thought I saw an article that said he was not.
Oh.
Well, it's a fun idea.
I hope I'm wrong, but I think I saw a rebuttal.
So for those who don't know, like, King Shark was not, like, an original member of the Suicide Squad, like, in the 90s incarnation of the comic, late 80s, early 90s, but has been one of the more fun cast members since. Is King Shark on the Flash TV show? Did they use him?
Yes, he was.
Yeah. How was he on that? I don't know if I saw much with him.
He was cool.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah, very good effect.
Same kind of deal? Was he kind of a entertainingly savage? Did he talk?
Michael Rooker says, da not.
Safe.
I don't know what that means, but clearly he's not working on it. He's not going to be King Shark, which is too bad because he'd be perfect.
Yeah. I think him as a cranky shark man seems like the perfect use of his approach.
I would expect him to show up in Suicide Squad at some point for some cameo, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Does not seem to be playing King Shark, which is sad.
That's too bad.
He's playing Amanda Waller.
He's playing Goro, weirdly.
That I would believe, actually.
He's playing Goro in Suicide Squad. All right.
You know, they've done Mortal Kombat DC before.
I was
going to
say,
some
they
point?
Did.
All right, let's talk trailers. So there's three notable ones. Let's talk about the most recent one, which is the trailer for Genndy Tartakovsky's new Primal. Getting on Adult Swim.
Yeah, Genndy Tartakovsky, you may know best from... Samurai Jack. That's the big one.
Yep.
And then before they did the CG Clone Wars cartoon for Star Wars, he did a bunch of shorts that were amazing, that were like even more larger than life than the regular cartoon.
Like, roughly about like 13 minutes or so. It was like a weird kind
of
short.
Well, a lot of them were actually just 3 to 5 minutes.
Oh, that's right.
And then they did a second season where they branched longer, and like they each one was like 10 minutes longer.
I just remember
something
the
like
Mace Windu versus
the entire like robot army
armada.
Or droid armada.
Those were awesome.
Yeah. There was also, I mean, the single best use of General Grievous.
Yep.
With him like in this, they were like in this wrecked hulk
scary.
of a ship, and he was killing off Jedi, and then they. Like one of those Republic gunships comes in and he takes on the whole gunship himself and like
the Ark 170s.
Yeah, there was also a great battle between who's the lady or not? She's not a Sith Lord. No, it's the bad guy chick.
Asajj Ventress.
Yeah. Asajj Ventress and Anakin had a great battle that they did almost like spaghetti western slow face off style, rain sizzling off of their like lightsabers as they face off. That was like really cinematic. That was how the first season ended. Anyway, if you haven't ever seen those, get your hands on them.
Yeah.
So Tartakovsky's new one.
The new one is called Primal, and it seems to be caveman dinosaur type
savage stuff. Adventure.
Savage adventure.
Violent
yeah.
caveman.
In fact, yeah, there's a vibe here that's less Samurai Jack and more heavy metal.
Yeah.
Because this dude, I don't know what he grabs, but he's got like either a hand axe or something.
It looks like a tooth.
Oh, it's like a giant tooth.
He's got a dinosaur.
And he's like hammering away at something, and like blood is spraying everywhere.
I think he's on top of the T-Rex, stabbing it to death
with its own tooth or something. Yeah, that sounds right. It's gonna. I'm actually not quite sure if I want the. I like action adventure Tartakovsky. I don't know if I want
Savage
action
Tartakovsky.
Violent Tartakovsky.
This looked pretty spectacular to me. The artwork looks amazing.
Yeah,
so.
The animation is great.
It did. Like it's slightly different from his normal style, which he's always got that kind of exaggerated, blockier style. But he like Bruce Timm, like he's a guy who knows how to animate.
Yeah,
one of the single best action directors I've seen in my whole life.
Here, if this is like another one of his like 15-minute episodes, or if this is gonna be full like 30
minutes.
It can't
be full. It's not Adult Swim, and they don't do full episodes.
Yeah,
so it's probably gonna be short.
So I wonder if it'll be like silent. Those cavemen don't really talk.
Possible. I don't know.
Possible.
It'd be kind of cool. All
right. There's also the new trailer for Watchmen over on HBO.
Yep.
The first trailer or teaser, right?
Yeah, we saw like a 10-second clip
yeah,
of like a couple of
things.
There's
a little baby teaser, but this is the first
trailer.
Right. And even this one is really kind of very tonally, like it's just about tone and little glimpses of maybe what's going on.
Yeah, it seems to be in the future. Not the future, it's the present.
Yeah, but like since Watchmen left off in like 1986... and that's the last sort of official thing that we've ever seen from them.
It looks like time has definitely gone on.
How long ago was that? 33
years
ago?
Yeah, maybe in 2019.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like there's a cult that's crocked up around Rorschach.
Yep. You were speculating, Randy, at one point that maybe these guys had, like, this is the journal has gotten out there and kind of like the dark web or something
that.
And people are almost like anonymous rallying around his symbology.
Yep. And then there seems to be like some vigilante justice going on. There's cops covered in masks. There's one woman who's either a cop or a vigilante, played by Regina King.
Yep.
Don Johnson seems to be, I don't know, local sheriff?
Or
maybe
something much larger.
Is he the one who says we thought they were gone, but we were wrong?
Yeah.
So it does seem, actually, I don't think I saw many like superheroes in it or vigilantes.
I think I only saw two.
We see we see Regina King's character, and we see Jeremy Irons as Ozymandias.
As the
then there was the other guy that had sort of like a metal face, like no face.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
I didn't quite catch that either. I saw police officers that seemed to be wearing like masks over their faces. Yeah, they were like bandanas or something like that. But I couldn't tell quite what their deal was. Like, are they trying to hide their identities because these like Rorschach vigilantes are killing cops?
Or has it become that the police are more kind of
like they're hybridizing it? Like the police is like a mercenary vigilante units or something?
Or they could, you know, government could be taking over and they are kind of like shock troops or something.
Maybe so. Yeah, I don't know.
I think it leaves a lot up to sort of your own.
I think how you feel this is gonna depend a lot largely on how you feel about Lindelof. And, like, The Leftovers and Lost, that kind of thing. I think there's a lot of people who are like, no Lindelof, never again. I generally have liked what he's done. I think it's always a little bit, there's always problems with it. But I'm curious about
Leftovers ended well, didn't it?
It did, but it was weird throughout. Like,
right.
Leftovers definitely had pretentiousness and blind alleys, just like everything else Lindelof does.
Yeah.
And I feel like
Watchmen
being pretentious makes sense.
And here's the thing, he always does good stuff. I mean, whether you like the ending of Lost doesn't mean that there weren't episodes that were amazing.
I think almost anybody could be sat down in front of like an individual episode and said, just watch this, even without any context, and have to agree at the end of it, like it was really masterfully put together.
Unless it was the Jack's Tattoo episode.
Well, you know, like you said,
I didn't say any
alleys.
Episode. I meant obviously some of their better episodes.
That is my point that I'm making, is that Lindelof is hit and miss.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's true, but I think this one will probably do well. I know HBO is searching after the end of Game of Thrones. They'll be searching for their next kind of mega hit.
The next thing to disappoint people.
If you want to be realistic about it, sure.
Although they may think we had, like, what, 7 seasons of love, and even if it's 1 season of hate or whatever, they're like, that 7 seasons of love made us a whole lot of money.
One season of hate with the best ratings they've ever had.
I mean,
who cares?
I think you have to realize that fandom in general hates itself.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it loves to argue.
That's what fandom does. It destroys what it loves. Yes.
So one thing I'll say this. I didn't know what I would want to see, if anything, from, you know, a future Watchmen thing. Everybody knows it's a pretty self-contained story. It's kind of done, even though it ends on a pregnant pause and a will this all come undone. kind of note. But because I've enjoyed the little expanded universe outings that they've done before Watchmen, and I need to get back into reading it, but I've liked parts of Doomsday Clock at least before I sort of fell off keeping up with it regularly. So, yeah, just on the level of a thought experiment of seeing where someone might go with it, I kind of like that I don't quite know what's going on. I think that's interesting.
Well, Dave, I think you're probably the biggest Watchmen fan in the room.
Probably so. Mm-hmm. And yet also the biggest sellout for Watchmen. I always like to bring out my fondness for the Watchmen beat-em-up game for the PlayStation 2.
Well, more were here, would slap you across the face.
You did not just say that.
And then he's like, is it any good? Can I play it?
It is two-player, Alan Moore. Oh, interesting. Split screen, or...
Can I be Rorschach?
He does like reading Rorschach.
He does.
I think this is one of these where the next trailer is going to be the one that'll really kind of tell us more story and where I'll be able to have a better sense for it. But there's almost no chance that I'm not going to try this out.
Yeah.
The cast is too good.
Yeah.
The cast is amazing.
I wonder, like... So if Ozymandias' plan sort of worked, then theoretically you would have a united world, mm-hmm. which is what they showed happening in that. But I always think that the lesson that I learned from 9/11 mm-hmm. is that we very briefly had a united world where everybody was like backing our play, and they're like, everybody's friends to America, and like within a year.
Yeah,
it was all out the door. It was all fractured.
Yeah.
So Ozymandias' plan might have just unraveled on its own without any need for Rorschach's vast conspiracy theory.
Yeah. It doesn't help that that's out there.
I will be interested to know how it unraveled. And I will also be curious to see if, like, you know, what they do with, like, the idea that before Dr. Manhattan left, he had set in motion various technologies and things like that had already changed the face of the world. They already had electric cars back in the 80s and stuff like that. Yeah. So there, I hope, you know, like, although I can imagine it's like, well, with Dr. Manhattan gone, you know, like the reactors or whatever that he used to have that, you know, kept all of that stuff up and running or have fell into disrepair and we had to give them up.
Well, also, if they go with it and run with it and the fact that he was giving people cancer, they might have spurned everything that he had worked on and been like, we can't use it. He has become the villain.
I mean, of course, he was not actually doing that. No. That was all the machinations of Ozymandias.
Yeah.
But... you're absolutely right. The public perception, I don't know that they ever kind of got past that.
Ozymandias will buy more perfume.
And let's see, I'm trying to think. Did the movie had him, the alien invasion stuff was transferred over to a Dr. Manhattan
It was madness. Superimposed over him, yes.
Right, but that was not, so I assume that they're not continuing with that one.
No, I think they're continuing for the book.
Huh, that's interesting.
I would imagine, though.
So are we going to finally get our, maybe...
Giant space alien?
You know, if they open with the one of, like, news clip type things, which is a quick way to catch up,
that'd be so cool.
A nightmarish, like, if they... Honestly, if they did it realistically the way we remember that horrific footage of post 9/11, or, like, 9/11, I mean... But with a squid.
It would be creepy.
Look, you could do it very nightmarishly.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it would, like, this almost Lovecraftian town of death.
I think if you did that, you would garner a lot of praise from Watchmen fans.
Yeah. That's
maybe
it.
Not. I don't know.
I think there are a fair amount... Like, the movie... You know, Snyder's movie actually has a fairly decent-sized fandom. I know people who don't particularly have ties to the comic... who really love the movie.
Yeah.
People who have strong ties to the comic tend to not love the movie. Sometimes they outright hate it. I kind of like the movie. I find it pretty watchable, but it's a weird piece.
It has a great opening credits.
Yeah. I think almost everybody would agree. The credits are pretty good.
Yeah, the credits are good.
So, we'll see. We'll see.
All right.
I'm watching
Last trailer to talk to is It 2.
Yep.
Is it just called It 2?
It Chapter 2, I think.
Yeah, that sounds more classy.
It Chapter 2. It Chapter 2, y'all.
So this is the adults versus Pennywise.
Yep. Which I know they're probably going to have some of the kids interspersed in here.
I wondered about that.
Oh, it looks like they are.
Yeah, because like all the kids seem to be shown again.
For some reason, I was thinking that when they did the first It, that the kids were only like on contract for that, and then I wasn't sure if they were going to return for this.
I hope they do.
But then it did really well, and then I think you're probably right. They probably figured that out. Nick... Remind me, I think this was the case, when they did it as a, I think, three-part miniseries back in the 90s.
Yes.
Did they they divide up the adult and kid stories in that one as well. So
no,
it's kind of like,
I feel like, because it opened with the adults.
Yeah, it's interspersed.
It did, but I thought that might only be a bookend. Because basically it opens with, who's the librarian? Mike?
Maybe? Wasn't Harry Dean Stanton's
librarian? No, Noah Wyle is librarian.
Oh,
Actually, sorry, I was talking about the 90s.
Interesting.
I was talking about the Dumb USA show.
Oh, I see. That's funny. Funny guy. I didn't know we had a comedian here. We already were talking about the comedian. It all comes back. Anyway, I think it is. Mike is the guy who was the librarian who stayed in Derry,
yes,
of the group of them. And he, like, you see him at, like, a crime scene. I did watch it somewhat recently. And you see him at the crime scene, and he's, like, clearly, like, the killings have started again, and I think you see he's going to go call them, and I thought it almost immediately then segued back to the kids in the 50s or 60s, and...
I thought it jumped back and forth between them.
I couldn't remember. The book for sure did. Right up until the end, it jumped back and forth.
I thought the miniseries mimicked King's actual story a little bit more than this, which is definitely cut in half.
Maybe that's the case, and I think, honestly, both ways work.
Yeah.
It's a little weird to have two stories building toward a climactic scene. It's a weird structure.
Yeah.
And splitting them up kind of makes more sense in terms of traditional narrative structure. It's like, okay, the kids thought they stopped him. Here's the story about where they found out in the sequel that they didn't and that they have to revisit it as adults. Anyway, on to the trailer. They do something different.
Yeah,
with
I was going to say, they actually focus on a single scene.
Yeah, for like over half of it.
They did a really good... So, I have not read the book. I read the first, I don't know, like 400 chapters or whatever.
Yep. you're like, okay.
Yeah, and it's like a little long-winded here. So, I don't know that much about what happens in it. I've seen the first movie... I've never seen the miniseries. I've seen the first movie once.
Yep.
So, I'm definitely sort of a casual fan of this.
Yep.
But, watching this trailer, I was like, wow, yeah, I really want to see this. Because it's a great, like, moody trailer.
Yeah, well, you know, when I was watching it, I knew this scene from the book and from the previous miniseries. And it's a creepy scene where, Beverly?
As
the adult, played by...
Is revisiting her home, and it's...
Who's
the actress? Claire, it's...
It's who's going to be in Dark Phoenix?
Jessica Chastain. She's visiting her old home where an old lady lives now, and there's a creepy conversation between them that seems friendly, but things start to get kind of weird.
Yeah, especially when she rolls down the hallway in a way that we see. But
yeah, like it's this creepy Silent Hilly sort of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, they stay on the scene, and it's like you don't know when something... First of all, you're not used to trailers like this as you're watching it, and you're like, well, something is about to just probably happen. Okay, maybe now. Maybe now.
Yeah.
And it's unnerving because you can't tell when it is going to occur.
It reminds me of what Shyamalan used to do with his trailers, where it'd be like once.
Yeah. I've advocated for that fairly often.
Yep.
There's especially certain movies I think it'd work for. I don't know if I actually would have thought it would for this one, because I think there's a lot of creepy, nightmarish imagery, and I think you could have cut together a perfectly adequate standard trailer.
Well, the last, like, 15 seconds of the trailer is kind of a montage of, like, various scene or
it
various
almost,
characters.
In its way, after going full creepy, it has that slightly adventurous quality of, like, the heroes gathering sort of thing. And they're clearly like, we're going to have to face this again.
Remind me who all's in it. I know Bill Hader. It's Jessica Chastain.
I don't remember who all it was.
There's at least one other notable actor.
It's a good cast.
Oh, it's Professor Xavier.
McAvoy.
Yeah, James McAvoy.
Yeah. Anyway, the cast looks good. And here's the funny thing. I have mixed reactions to the first it chapter one.
Yeah.
I think it had a lot of, was overall pretty good. But I think that scares were, like, primarily jump scares, which I kind of found cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But I also thought it had a lot of great visuals and some notable scenes. And I thought it updated some of King's ideas in good ways.
I also liked all the kid actors.
The kid actors were all good.
They did a great job.
In a weird way, I almost thought they actually swore too much in it. And they're trying to be realistic.
Well, what's his name supposed to be? Like, supposed to be swearing, like, constantly.
Yeah, but they, when I read the book, after that, or during that, I guess, because I was actually listening to it on audio, the kids, although foul-mouthed at times, were not as much as they were in the movie. It was one of those that actually got turned up a little bit. But it made some good choices by setting it in the 80s instead of the 60s. For the kids.
Kids swore more in the 80s.
It played off sort of the Stranger Things vibe that was already going strong in the pop culture. And it meant that when they projected forward into the present, they could do it in 2019, which was exactly what Stephen King was doing at the time. He was looking at his past, like the kind of era he grew up in the 60s, and then taking it to the present of then, like, 1984. So, yeah, they just they went ahead and set it in the 80s, and now it's the adult story is in the 2000s or 2019.
And we get to see more creepy Bill Skarsgård.
Yep. His particular mannerisms are very creepy, and the way they film him and the brief glimpses you have in this are cool. You know, what was interesting to me is there's a scene in this where he's being held aloft by a bunch of balloons.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of wild camera pan under him as he like looks like he's like 30 or 40 feet up in the air gliding over the big statue of, is it Paul Bunyan?
It is.
That's like in the town square. And there's like a few notable scenes in that with that statue. Yeah. Even like that statue like comes to life in a way that's the kind of thing you can't normally film in a movie without it being silly. In a Stephen King book, we were talking about The Shining the other day, and I was saying how there's a creepy snowmobile scene in there.
It is.
Where the kid is like likening it to a wasp in his head, and it becomes very creepy in the novel. And you said they did it in the TV miniseries.
Yep.
But it's hard for me to imagine it translating well. Yeah. And I think the Paul Bunyan one is another one that is going to be tricky if they mess with it. But
I kind of think they won't.
But they may update it. They may do a thing where it's less that it comes to life and more that something creepy happens around it. Or a dream that involves it, or who knows what. But yeah, it looked pretty good.
I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm way more interested than I thought I was going to be.
I will see it probably opening weekend.
You think that actress playing the old lady in the house had fun playing that scene?
Oh definitely.
Like I bet a lot of people, like the older actors and actresses, are called upon to play grandmas and grandpas and give homespun wisdom and stuff like that. It's not often you get to say really creepy things.
Yeah. Would you like to scare the hell out of Jessica Chastain?
Oh dear,
sign me up.
But yeah, it looks good. It retroactively actually made me like, I think, the previous one a little bit more and want to revisit it. I'm sure I'll rewatch it before I watch the new one.
Yeah, I definitely want to rewatch it because I don't remember a lot.
When is it coming out?
I don't know, this summer sometime, right?
Okay. Yep. Oh, cool. So it's pretty soon.
Yeah. All right, we're going to talk about comics for the week in just a second.
One familiar cry.
We were talking comics for the week of Wednesday, May 15th, and I'm going to start.
All right, cool. Just do it.
I'm going to start. There's a bunch of War Realm stuff this week. I have not been reading all of it, but I did want to read this one called Giant Man, which really should be called Giant Men.
Because there's like four of them, right?
Because there's four of them. So this is a story featuring Scott Lang, Roz Malhotra, who is the Giant Man introduced in Nick Spencer's Ant-Man run, Tom Foster, the nephew of Bill Foster, Goliath,
yep.
Because Goliath was killed in Civil War, and I'd forgotten about that until I read this book and got angry all over again. He was killed by Clor. And then Eric Joston, a.k.a. Atlas, character from the Thunderbolts, who I've always had a fondness for.
Yeah.
Basically, Freya calls Ant-Man, and she's like, look, I want revenge on La Fae for killing Loki, because Loki's been eaten by La Fae, although we'll see how long it lasts. And he's like, she's like, I want you to go in the Frost Giant realm, which has become Florida, because all the Frost Giants have taken over Florida.
Yep.
Is this a commentary on the craziness that is Florida?
She does mention it, yeah. She does say apparently it was always crazy. But so she puts together this team of giant men who can go, like, magic won't work. They can't use sorcery to disguise them, so basically they just got to, like, get up to their full 65-foot height, which is, like, minimum height for a Frost Giant. And put on, like, makeup and stuff and go in undercover as Frost Giants.
Oh, I didn't realize that they actually go undercover. That's kind of cool.
Yep. So
I guess the deal is you got a Frost Giant problem, you send in some giants to deal with it.
So they basically are supposed to infiltrate this, what was previously Yeehaw Junction, Florida, and go deal with Lafay's, go do an assassination mission, basically. It goes hilariously wrong. It hits a lot of my favorite genre stuff. I like all these characters. It is essentially kind of a heisty type thing where you're, like, infiltrating.
That does not happen very often with Giant Man, yep. And that's, I think, probably what kind of one of the cool things about it.
I like the art a lot, and it's got a good sense of humor. I really enjoyed this, and it's sort of, it's a side story. Like, you really don't have to read this to read War of the Realms, and you don't have to read War of the Realms to read this. It's just hey, you want to see a bunch of giant men dressed up as Frost Giants going to try to infiltrate Frost Giant Land in Florida. That's what you got here. Advertised and delivered.
Nice.
Dave?
It's a miniseries, though. How many?
It's a miniseries.
How many issues?
3, 4, I don't know. They never tell us.
Let's say 13.
Sure, 13 issues.
13 issues of Giant Man infiltration.
Yep.
Let's see. Okay, yes, my pick of the week this week is Guardians of the Galaxy number 5, the relaunch from Donny Cates, Marvel's new golden boy.
It's true.
And it begins with Star-Lord's death. Or does it? I'm not going to spoil it too much, but reports of his death may have been exaggerated. And Donny Cates having some fun with the old superhero cliffhanger stuff in this, though. As people may remember, everybody was on the hunt for Gamora because the prevailing thought was that Thanos cast his, when he died, cast his mind into her. Mm-hmm. They know that he had the ability to do that. So everybody, a lot of people are hunting for him. They have what they call the Dark Guardians, which was Thanos' brother Star Fox and a bunch of other kind of, I'm going to say, edgier Marvel heroes, primarily like Gladiator from the Imperial Guard and... I forget who all else was in there. A bunch of scary people.
Cosmic Ghost Rider.
Yeah, a bunch of these crazy Wraith. Dudes. Oh, yeah, Wraith from the old Annihilation miniseries from Marvel. They did some fun left-field fix. They're all after him. And the Guardians that we know, as well as a few of their new members, which includes, like, Moondragon and Beta Ray Bill, they were kind of trying to run interference and just figure things out, but maybe stop people from just straight-up going in mercilessly killing Gamora before they knew what was going on. In this one, they first of all call on a cool ally from Beta Ray Bill.
That's
awesome. Was a bit of a tip of the hat to something else Donny Cates wrote recently.
Yeah.
And there's even, I think, maybe a meta line in there about the fact that nobody read that other project.
It's very true.
Because somebody is like, oh, wow, I hadn't heard about this. And he's like, not many people did. But the scene works perfectly fine without getting into, like, goofy meta territory. So they've all got their plans. And then, meanwhile, Gamora has been captured by the Dark Guardians. And they are trying to figure out what to do with her, and this is like where it all kind of all comes to a head. You know, she's brought before Star Fox to render judgment, and then something crazy happens. And I don't want to say who it is, but a unexpected player shows up, and it's not Thanos. It was a pretty cool... There's some cool twists and turns. There's actually one twist in here, which I was kind of hoping for.
Yep.
But also could lead to something I don't like. I'm just going to have to see what happens in the next issue. Awesome. In a weird case, for the most part, though, I was happy with it because even if my worst fear is realized, and it goes, this twist happens in a direction I don't like, it's the kind of direction that's undone all the time in comics.
Right.
And I think overall it works well enough in the context of this story.
I just want to know why Star Fox stole Professor Xavier's hover chair. Because that is like the exact design.
I imagine that was like a Shi'ar hover chair.
Oh, was it a Shi'ar?
He didn't just build that, I think. I think it was like Lilandra hooked him up.
That makes more sense now.
So really, Lilandra might well have been stealing Titan technology for hover chairs or something. I don't know.
Well, Gladiator's involved. I guess Gladiator could have gotten him a hover chair.
Yeah, he's like, you look uncomfortable in that wheeled chair.
Because isn't Gladiator the Emperor now? I believe he is
Probably
the
so.
Emperor. I think
he's
he
a
is.
Very hands-on emperor if he's out there, like, leading. His main thing is questing after people to execute
them. He only knows one way to lead.
He was the emperor back in War of Kings, but that was, like, 10 years ago. Is he still emperor?
I don't know. Is Lalandra back?
I don't know.
I didn't get the impression he was emperor. You would have at least said something like, he probably in there, like, I should be attending to affairs of state, but I'd rather go and execute this war criminal. And I don't think he ever actually mentioned anything like that.
I think my favorite thing about this, and I have been reading off and on, is that Donny Cates, while doing his own thing, feels very kind of Abnett Lanning in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Like that
he's
voice
using
still
the,
rings true.
He's using the playground of the cosmic Marvel universe, having some fun with it, so it's not quite as goofy as I want to say the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, no. But it's got some of that fun factor in there, even though this is pretty serious stuff going on.
Yeah. Literal life and death.
That's true. But anyway, yeah, I'm still enjoying it, and I guess there is one more issue left to kind of wrap up this big first story arc, and I will be there for it.
Nick?
I want to talk about Spider-Man Life Story number 3,
yep.
Which is subtitled The 80s, which is a fun time in comic book world. It's kind of less fun in Spider-Man this way.
The events that they key off of are some dark events, but The 80s was also like, hypothetically, it's like Roger Stern's run and kind of classic adventure Spider-Man. But there's a few stories that are best known Spider-Man stories from the era, and they tend to be dark.
Yeah, and well, this also is like Secret Wars.
Yeah.
Which I thought was cool, and seeing sort of this world's Secret Wars, which is kind of legacy style. So, like, Reed Richards is kind of an older Reed Richards.
Yeah, although I was surprised how little was changed in those pictures.
Right, yeah. It looks like it is meant to roughly be the Secret Wars we knew. Thor looks like 1980s Thor with classic costume and everything. But...
yeah, there are definitely some still people, but, I mean, there are changes here. I mean, Cyclops has a weird costume, which I didn't realize.
Yeah, yeah.
Otto Octavius is a little on the older side. Spider-Man wears a kind of armored suit,
I like the Spidey suit, actually.
Yeah, I thought this was better than the one in the second issue, which was kind of a little on the odd side, but...
but, of course, it won't be his final costume in this, because that's the other big thing that happened in the 80s.
Yeah, and then they touched down, of course, on Kraven's Last Hunt, which is interesting. But it's more sort of the ancillary stuff, the conversations that Spider-Man, or Peter Parker has with sort of his co-stars that I really kind of glommed onto a bit more. The relationship with MJ in here is extremely interesting.
You know, my only gripe with this is that it does seem like the Chip Zdarsky decided that Peter's going to have a lovelorn life.
Yeah.
Like his relationship with Gwen was troubled, his relationship with Mary Jane's been troubled, and his relationship with May has been troubled. Well, like, it's all troubled.
I think that comes down to, like, that's been kind of a trope for Peter Parker over decades, and shortening that into sort of a legacy-style story. Yeah.
In a meta way, it absolutely, like, he is the Charlie Brown of superheroes.
Yeah, it definitely fits.
But during the span of, like, how long was he married to MJ before?
Oh, like 20 years.
Yeah.
I thought it was, like, 10 or 15.
No, it was like
90s to, like, 1990 to 2005? Or something like that.
I don't know. I thought it was like 20 years.
I'm betting it's less than that.
All right.
But I believe it may have been one of those things where, like, they were married longer than they weren't, or something like that.
That was definitely the case.
In any case, it actually still does kind of bug me that they, like, I actually feel like that could be, even in this territory, this could have been a more stable relationship. Yeah. I mean, like, yes, ups and downs, but they could still be each other's rock, kind of.
Exactly.
But as it happens, it still unfolds in an interesting way. Like, they're...
so, sorry.
Go ahead.
Spider-Man Annual, 1987. One More Day, 2007. 20 years.
Wait, 87?
Yep.
Is when they got married?
Yep.
Wow.
I thought that was later than that.
Nope. 1987.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, this is a dark story. I mean, but I think it is a very interesting one.
Well, Peter's feeling his age in this. It's the first one of the various, as the third arc out, and roughly 30 years, I guess, into his career,
I like his solution with his new costume because of it.
I like the reason he has
the costume. Yeah, the reason is great. But, I mean, there's also sort of the worry about the costume as well. And there are stuff in here that I'm not going to spoil that it felt very Peter, like him being a little more... thoughtful and
Well, this Peter Parker has been a scientist all his life.
Yes.
I like that Zdarsky has the benefit of hindsight to go see what's been done and to sort of, like, incorporate it and to do a sort of, it's not unlike what they were doing with that X-Men Grand Design.
Yeah, a little bit,
but less weird.
Yeah, Mark Bagley is fine. I still think it's would have been serviced by a better artist, but
he's fine.
He's fine.
But here's the thing. I think I would simply say a more maybe appropriate artist. He's a good artist, but, like, his storytelling is all perfectly good in that.
Sure,
I mean, like, even better than good at times, I would say. I don't know if I'd maybe would want somebody who's a little bit better at making me feel the period piece stuff.
Yeah, Marcus Martin would have been amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, and then there's larger impacts of the Marvel Universe throughout, and... I like seeing that peppered in. Like in the first one, that was the Iron Man, Captain America sort of Civil War. There's definitely more in here about other things. So I like that Zdarsky is getting a chance to sort of create his own Marvel universe in some ways.
Let's lay some odds. Do things end good or bad for Spidey in this?
I'm gonna say, I mean, it's gonna end with his death, right? I mean,
presumably,
it's a story.
But does it manage to play out somewhat peacefully, or is it a sad story?
I feel like
it's hard to imagine them going too tragic.
I feel like Zdarsky will not give a sad ending.
Well, let's see.
It might be sort of a, you know, life well lived kind of.
Actually, you know what I was just thinking? If each book reflects the era it was, you know, it's set in, and it does.
Yep.
Then Miles has to show in like the final volume.
That makes sense.
Spidey will be. Let's see if he's like what 40 or something in the 80s. He's gonna like 70s. He's like could be in his 70s when they when they wrap up.
Yeah.
And yeah, I could see him like in almost doing the mentor thing.
Yeah.
There, that would actually be pretty cool if it was something like that.
I imagine he and MJ will get back together again. Or
yeah.
There, I don't see him going dark, too dark.
I mean, the thing is, it's gotten darker with every issue.
That's true. But I feel like it's probably gonna do kind of the darkest Empire Strikes Back, and then it's gonna rise back up. As
right.
More
the equivalent
kind of
like, you know, this is the Gwen Stacy darkness stuff, and then there will be some sort of release after that.
You know what I find really interesting about this series is that it ends every. I think issue is ended on a cliffhanger.
Yeah,
That we then never see fully resolved.
True.
Like we see the results of it 10 years later, but the cliffhanger is its own reward, which is an interesting thing to do. Like, I would love to see more of this world.
Structurally, it's pretty interesting experiment. You know, it does occur to me though, if we're waiting for it to get a little bit lighter, when they get to the '90s, that means Venom and Carnage.
Yeah.
I don't think, because I think they did a fair amount, well, they may also revisit the clone stuff, which was a big thing in the 70s.
Hobgoblin, maybe? No.
That would have been 80s, too, and they didn't choose to make that a big thing.
Yeah. I don't know what else you would hit on in the 90s.
I don't know. Venom and Carnage seems like the obvious one. There's probably something we're forgetting.
Yeah.
Rocket Racer.
Actually, that would be great to put in a little bit of a little lightheartedness could probably happen, but Peter will be running into those, like, in what, his... I don't know if he's in his 40s or 50s.
He'll be in his 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want to run into Venom for the first time in your 50s.
Well, I think Venom starts in this book. So
yeah. Right.
Probably it mostly happens in the 80s. Yeah.
That's true.
It's interesting. I think Zdarsky has become a kind of go-to writer for Marvel, and I really appreciate like the his talent. He has become a fantastic writer.
Yep.
Secondary picnic?
My secondary pick is Star Wars TIE Fighter number 2.
Yeah, you like the first one.
I like the first one, even though I thought it was a little weird to root for Imperial cadets in a lot of ways.
Were they fighting bad people?
They were fighting the rebellion.
Real nice, Nick.
Yeah.
I was rooting for the villains
It's
now.
Their Shadow Squadron, or Squadron 5 Shadow Wing,
was
which is like
of
their
them...
elite group.
Were any of them as I think was maybe hinted at, like a mole or something?
There
like that
is
the
an
rebellion?
Infiltrator, but it's the secondary story is more a kind of a strange one where it's Imperial versus Imperial.
Okay.
Which I haven't seen much of in like the Star Wars universe.
Yeah.
Kind of this offshoot of the Imperial Army. And it's a really, really cool story. That I am curious to see where is it Jody Houser? Yeah, Jody Houser goes with it because she's created some interesting characters, put them in interesting situations, and that's half the battle. I mean, seeing interesting characters do interesting things.
The other half
things.
Is proton torpedoes.
Yes, proton torpedoes. that's definitely... but, I mean, this is sort of just squadron tactics and...
A pretty serious look at their internal stuff and not just through combat, right? It looks like there's a fair amount of behind the scenes. Are they, like, at, like, a... deck somewhere, or
they're basically taken captive.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so there's some interesting twists and turns in this one, and also I like the fact that every issue has sort of a backup story, and what that backup story is sort of a piece of each member of the squadron's history.
Okay.
Like, this is a conversation between one of the guys.
Does that mean that, like, one of the ones, when we get their history, that's where we're going to find out they're a mole?
This one is about him and his brother. And sort of seeing that relationship and sort of how it fits in and how it sort of molds him. And
that sounds pretty interesting.
It's an interesting idea.
I dig it.
Again, he's Imperial, so it should be evil. But,
right.
You know. I think Jody Hauser's done a lot of good. Dave, do you have a backup pick?
Yeah, I'm all superhero-y this week. My backup pick this week is Teen Titans number 30, which I've been, our coworker Anna's been following this, and I believe she has a hero worship for the character Crash, aka Crush. Lobo's Crush.
Crush, not Crash.
Crush. Right. Lobo's daughter, yes. Crush, and who's playing like this kind of like. The tough wild card in there. But they're kind of... They've got several wild cards, including their leader, Damien.
I was going to say, Damien's like the...
And at the heart of the current storyline, which involved big events with a crossover with Deathstroke, and like the possibility that Red Arrow may have killed Deathstroke, you know, in as much as anybody kills any major villain in DC. But, like I don't think... I can spoil... I'm going to go and spoil this because it's... In the past, at this point, she'd like put an arrow right through his head, like not.
But knowing who this Red Arrow is, it actually makes sense. It's Shadow's daughter,
right?
Which is a little. She's definitely more That's dark. Cool.
Yep. Yep. And
you can't have two of all wild cards. That didn't work.
Actually, there's this Kid Flash, is the
kind of stable
straightest
one.
Of straight arrows. And then there's what's her name? Jin? Is that what it is? Or Genie? I can't remember.
New character?
Yeah, she's kind of in a way filling that role that somewhat that the power scheme at least that Raven had way back when. Yeah, her name is Jin, like DJINN, like yeah. A genie in Arabic folklore. Anyway, the she's a pretty good person too. And Crush is mercenary, but not killer, I think.
Oh, interesting.
So, they're...
I just assumed she was, like, kind of Lobo-ish.
She's Lobo-ish, but she also has a... interesting, what... So, when this begins, this is the epilogue to the storyline. And as far as they know, one of them has killed Deathstroke. Robin's secret sort of underground prison that he had that they didn't know about where all the villains that they'd been capturing, they'd been illegally housed there. Everything blows up in this.
I think he watched a couple of episodes of the Flash TV show and was like, oh, I could do that.
I think so. I think he was like, yes, this needs... But clearly with the idea of this needs to be addressed. And so the morality of that is a big thing in this one. And interestingly, what sets off a... not quite full-on physical confrontation between them, but what sets off a confrontation is that Robin is kind of getting in the face of Jin, and that is who Crush has a crush on. And that's definitely a don't you dare hit her kind of thing, yeah. And it, like, spirals at that point. And a pretty entertaining superhero thing where you can have a physical confrontation along with a spoken moral confrontation. But yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes when you push these stories to the edge of like, should superheroes kill? And if they don't kill because they're so high and mighty, well, have they sacrificed, you know, if that person gets out and causes destruction and death, you know, is that
held accountable for
it? Right. Are they held accountable for it? Sometimes because there's not a great answer for that, because the truth is that, you know, villains escaping is just a trope of the genre. And I can't quite tell where they're ultimately going to head for this, but it's pretty entertaining. I like watching these characters together, and I've been thinking about picking up the trade paperback for it. Was it Adam Glass writing this? Who? He's from Supernatural, right?
He might be. He wrote Suicide Squad.
Yeah, he also wrote Suicide Squad.
Yeah, I remember looking him up at one point. He was one
art.
Of the Supernatural.
I think that's really nice.
The art is fantastic in it. It actually reminds me of the best of, was it Rick Leonardi, maybe, back in the day?
Hmm.
It reminded me of him at his best.
Oh, I can see that.
Oh, Bernard Chang. Hmm. I was mixing him up.
Some good character designs, too.
He's been around for a while.
Yeah, it's great. There's also a fun ending to this when, like, in some ways, a wild card gets thrown into their big team fight that should be fun to watch how it plays out afterwards. Anyway... A surprisingly fun book that I have just kind of like wandered into and may end up kind of following more closely. We'll see.
My backup pick is Immortal Hulk number 17. I've picked numerous issues of this book. This is a throwdown. So they're in Shadow Base Site B. This is the mysterious government organization that's been tracking down the Hulk. They dissected the Hulk, and they have in this new status quo. Basically, when the sun is up, it's not Hulk; it's Banner. And so Banner is in this government institution. He's being hunted down by Bushwhacker, the guy who can make his hands into guns.
Oh, yeah.
And
one of those weird old 80s villains.
Yeah.
And so it is a like game of cat and mouse throughout this government institution. But the secret weapon that Banner has is
he's stuck as Banner.
He's Banner.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
The secret weapon Banner has is that he's not Banner, he's Joe Fixit. at least that's who he is mentally. And so he's using all of Joe Fixit's abilities.
Oh, that's fun.
And occasionally he like slips in and uses some of Banner's abilities and just basically smarts his way out of this confrontation.
Al Ewing must have grown up and read a ton of Peter David Hulk.
Al Ewing is nodding to every Hulk here.
He's engaged with the chimerical nature of Hulk, where he's like, there's not like one set status quo.
Right. Which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
This is a really good issue. I really like seeing Joe Fixit again. Even if we're not seeing Joe Fixit himself, I like seeing the personality. The artwork by, is it Joe Bennett?
Yeah, it's Joe Bennett.
Is really, really nice.
He's been on it from the beginning, right?
Yeah. And there's some good sort of horror moments in here. And then the reveal at the end about them what they're working on is really interesting. This is just, it's really the best Hulk book we've had in a long, long time. And they're taking it in different directions and totally worth a read.
There's also the fourth volume of that?
The third volume of the third volume hit this week. That's also on my stack. Also on my stack, Daredevil number 5, which is a really good issue by Zdarsky, talking about going dark. That guy's writing darker books these days.
It's very sad, Matt Murdock on the cover of that.
Yep,
but it's a beautiful painting.
Yeah,
like,
it's beautiful.
There is a long tradition of defeated hero on the cover, and he definitely has the look of that on it, but it's good. It's up there kind of with the Spider-Man throwing away his costume kind of style. Yep.
Then there's Fair Lady number 2. This is the Image book about a sort of a it's basically a Magnum P.I. set in a fantasy world. In fact, she even lives in a wizard's tower with a sort of snotty butler type who is her Higgins. Her partner, instead of being a TC with a helicopter, is a giant tiger man. But it's very Magnum P.I. inspired. And it is a...
Like, it wears its inspiration on its sleeve.
This is a done-in-one murder mystery story with sort of a woman comes to her, says her husband was murdered by a dragon. She doesn't believe it, and so this Fair Lady, the lead, goes looking into it. Fair Man is what they call private investigators. That's why they call her Fair Lady. She's a war veteran. It's a really good standalone, and interestingly, each issue of this is completely standalone. You don't have to read the first one at all. And actually, I like this one considerably better than the second one, the first one. Sabrina the Teenage Witch number 2 continues to have some really fun Sabrina stuff, really nice art, good character stuff, some really good stuff with the ants this issue. And then last stop on the red line, number 1, we have a signing for this. If you're listening to this podcast anytime after, say, 12:30 on Wednesday, it's already happened.
Yep.
But if you're listening to it like late at night or early in the morning, it is from 10 o'clock to 12:30. Artist Sam Lotfi is going to be here. The art on this is really beautiful.
Supernatural murder mystery kind of story.
Supernatural murder mystery set in Boston. Come out and get that signed. And then I've got a bunch of trades in my stack. So I haven't read through all of this, but I noticed there's a bunch of trades this week. There's something called Samurai Chef. I don't know what else to tell you about that. It's about Samurai Chef. Dream Daddy, a dad dating comic book, is all about... It's a video game in which gay dads date.
This was a real game.
Yes.
Because I remember I've had some friends who played it and loved it.
It's a real game. These are comics based in it. I read the first one. It's pretty fun. It's basically an anthology. There's like 6 different stories in it. That is either for you or very much not for you. Camp is another all-ages book from Houghton Mifflin about a couple of girls at camp. Glitch is a book about a girl and her best friend who wind up in this new video game, and they get drawn into the game and sort of Dungeons and Dragons style.
We've all been
really
there.
Pretty artwork. It's a Scholastic, so it's the guys who did Bone, Amulet, Cleopatra in Space.
Do they do Raina Telgemeier stuff?
Raina Telgemeier stuff, yeah. Yes.
They've got a pretty good track record.
Image has the first trade of Bitter Root, which I need to catch up on. And then, of course, the latest trade of Rat Queens, Volume 6, which is the return of Rat Queens, and Curtis Weeby's final run. That's all stuff on my stack. What else you got?
I don't have actually anything else super of note. Nick, what do you have?
So, Amazing Spider-Man 21, which continues the Hunted story. This issue sees Peter fighting against genetically modified copies of Vermin. which is interesting.
Vermin, the otherwise obscure kind of Ratman character, if he had not had a major role in one of the most famous Spider-Man stories of all time, Kraven's Last Hunt.
Exactly. Uncanny X-Men 18, which sees the X-Men go up against another sort of big foe and their henchmen. Things do not go well for a lot of people. Batman 71 sort of sees Batman finally going up against Bane with beautiful artwork by Michael Janin. And then there's War of the Realms, which the main book, number 4, came out, which continues the adventures of Malekith trying to take over everything. Then there's Strike Force, which is sort of Carol Danvers forming her team in North America trying to stop the various forces, teaming up with Deadpool and, is it Hulkverine?
Yeah.
Venom and Sif and Namor, which is, it's a lot of fun. And then Spider-Man and the League of Realms, which he is joining a sort of special forces mission team of a member from each of the realms of the world, trying to sneak into Africa and take over sort of a spot where the angels have taken over.
Okay.
Yeah, so a lot of cool stuff. Like you do.
Mm-hmm.
But that is everything I've got.
All right. We'll be back in just a second to talk about Detective Pikachu and possibly some board games.
Talking about comics, movies, and fame. They even talk about board games. No week is the same.
Alright, so as has become our tradition, when the three of us see a movie, we are going to do a spoiler review of Pokemon Detective Pikachu. If you've not seen it, there's really not a ton of spoilers in it, but you should probably
see it. I actually feel like the nature of the mystery is a pretty big spoiler if you're going to kind of enjoy that sort of thing.
Yeah,
it's it is a mystery, and there's some kind of fun twists and turns to it. So we were telling our coworker Anna, who was kind of like, "Oh, what happens? Who's the big bad guy?" and all this stuff. And I was saying, if you like Pokemon, and she grew up with Pokemon, and she likes it, then you should go. You should give this movie a shot. I feel like it's a good solid movie. You will I think find it some degree of good or very good.
I would say that is actually the defining characteristic based on the reactions of friends. My reaction, the reaction everybody has seen, is that whether you're going to like this movie or not really depends on whether or not you like Pokemon.
Right.
Like, if you have,
I do think that, like, yeah, if you're going to see this and you don't like Pokemon, then that's weird.
Or even if you have no attachment to them at all.
Right.
I dragged my wife to it, and she was like, she laughed at a few of the jokes. Yeah. There are some great jokes in here. But it was ultimately not for her, because she didn't grow up with Pokemon.
I think I'm probably on our spectrum the one who liked it the least.
Yep. And you are the one person in the among us, Randy, who has not particularly watched the cartoon, I believe.
Because I don't like them.
Yeah. Nick and I have enjoyed the cartoon.
Yeah, the cartoon's
I've
fun.
Only watched, like, maybe the first season or so, and I was definitely, like, I was too old for Pokemon, but I dated somebody who watched Pokemon, and so I watched Pokemon.
Yeah.
And what I found is that it was delightful. That instead, rather than being the strange world of, like, monster cockfighting that everybody snarkily joked about it as. It was more like a camping adventure as Ash and his buddies went around and learned life lessons and got to meet monsters and occasionally let them go because they're good people. And the Pokemon themselves were adorable.
I mean, it was definitely one of those properties that came after after I had grown up and I thought it was silly, childish things.
Yeah.
Sort of like Mighty Morphin Power Rangers and stuff like that, where I was like, no, I can't do that. It's stupid.
Why can't it be serious like He-Man was when I was a child?
Of course, because everyone has that mentality for a little while. But I've returned, and I've kind of learned to love them. It has a charm. Even the creatures say their names.
And that's their main method of dialogue, is versions of their name. And Randy, you do have some fondness for it because you've been playing Pokemon Go, and so you know some of the names and characters and all that stuff. And so there's at least a foot in there.
Yeah, I think the thing I liked the most about this was Rhyme City, the setting.
Yeah, the setting is great.
The notion of a city where some sort of visionary executive is like, hey, instead of, like, just grabbing them and doing them for, like, fighting each other, what if we, like, live in harmony with the Pokemon, so everybody has a Pokemon.
Played by the great actor Bill Nye.
Bill Nye. Yep. Who I didn't think he was great in this, unfortunately.
I mean, he was kind of phoning it in a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. Kind of doing the larger-than-life thing. But
yeah.
But, yes, the city of Rhyme City is super fun. It's It actually, like, in if you just take screenshots, so a buddy of mine was joking because I posted one of the screenshots on Facebook, and he was like, it does look like Blade Runner almost, yeah, you know, does. It's got that sort of neon-lit thing.
Well, and also, like, the opening credits, the titling definitely has that kind of neon-noir kind of Blade Runner.
Yeah, I heard somebody call this baby's first noir. Because it kind of is. It's got that whole, my partner was killed.
Well, yeah, it's definitely kind of a Sam Spade.
Yeah. Let's just quick say what the plot is. Whoever the kid is, what's his name?
I don't actually know. Justice Smith is
a But name. Like yeah. a, what is he, 20-something? He's like an insurance guy.
Yeah, he's like 25.
He and the lead girl both seem like younger. I think they wanted to split the difference between Ash and what's her name?
Yeah, Misty.
And a grown-up, because they're definitely in their 20s, but they play like teenagers.
Yeah, it's true. His father, who was a detective in Rhyme City, has died, and there's a mystery surrounding it. He comes to, like, collect his effects and stuff like that. And along the way, gets embroiled in a mystery when he runs into this Pikachu. His father's Pokemon partner, who inexplicably he alone can understand, since everybody else just, they're essentially pets for everybody else. They're just animals. But he can understand him, and to figure out he's got amnesia, and to figure out they both have mysteries to resolve, and so they both set about finding out how his father died, who the big bad guys are, how it involves other Pokemon and stuff in the city.
And it involves Mewtwo, the most powerful Pokemon of all, which, by the way,
absolutely,
they open with, which I thought was good, because we'd all seen the trailers. Yeah. I would have been disappointed if Mewtwo was like the big reveal. But he's not the big reveal. In fact, things around him are the big reveal.
I believe he was like the main storyline in like the Pokemon movie, the animated one that came out 10 or 15 years ago or whatever it was. And here they kind of take him as he's a side part of the story. Mm-hmm. He's an integral part, and he's like the dangerous, scary Pokemon guy.
Yeah, well, he's
like Frankenstein.
Well, he's also like Professor X type. Like, he has psychic powers. He's when we finally find out about his realities, he's very this very wise character.
Yep.
And that he's like the most powerful. He can do all these things that nobody else can do, and I feel like he was their Superman in a lot of ways too.
Yeah, that's true. He's also like, but in some ways he's like more alien. He's a little Dr. Manhattan.
He's like Dr. Manhattan.
It's a child's first Watchmen too. so the fun of the movie is kind of watching the investigation and the banter between the lead character and Detective Pikachu, voiced by Ryan Reynolds.
Having seen it now, Dave.
Yep.
How do you feel about Ryan Reynolds? Do you feel like Danny DeVito would have been a better call?
Ryan Reynolds ends up working particularly well due to some of the plot turns.
I agree, but I still would rather have been Danny DeVito.
I kind of don't want to say what the final plot turn is.
Really?
I don't know. What do you think, Nick?
I'm open just gonna for blab whatever.
It. It's simply for the fact that Danny DeVito might be too old to play the role that is required of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
All right, do we want to say what it is?
No, it's fine. We didn't.
Okay.
We'll leave it alone.
The funnest thing, one of the fun things is that throughout the whole thing, there's like, in a way that would have been obnoxious if it was George Lucas, like putting a bunch of little droids and little creatures in every single scene. It's super fun in a Pokemon thing because spotting and catching Pokemon is what all the games are about.
Yeah, when I'm watching the early parts, just like the early part of the movie,
there's a great opening.
Like, there's like Pidgeots or whatever.
And
I was like, okay, so they're everywhere in this world.
There's also a really fun opening where you find out that this this 20-something guy who ended up in kind of a boring job wanted to be like a Pokemon
trainer. And his friend is trying to get him a Pokemon.
Right, and you see the failed venture, his attempt to catch a Cubone. The weird little, where's the skull of an ancestor?
It's usually his dead mom or something.
Which they specifically mentioned this. It is one of the weirdest ones.
Yeah.
And I did like how, although there's, of course, Pikachu is used in this and several other famous ones like Charizard and Bulbasaur.
Yep.
They used some obscure ones, too, or lesser-known ones. And it was fun to see how they did that. So the very first one that you really see in any depth is him trying to capture the one who wears the skull of his mother. and it's like a weird and funny scene.
Exactly.
So I thought the lead character was kind of bland.
He is a little bit.
But I thought the Go Reporter and Psyduck were great.
Psyduck was particularly great. I thought her, she was fine. I thought they were both kind of just one-note-ish in a lot of ways.
I have to say, the guy who they sort of put up as the main bad guy, who we knew wasn't going to be the main bad guy. Was played by Chris Gere.
Yep.
Who is the lead in one of my favorite shows just wrapped, You're the Worst, in which he plays...
Oh, is that him?
And he plays this, like, pretentious British author... And that show is full of, like, filthy sex.
Uh-huh.
And so having him in this kids' movie was breaking my brain a little, and also hilarious.
That's hilarious.
He's like, I don't want to be in your movie. Oh, you're going to pay me what?
Yeah. I like, but just, like, they finished that story, and the lead couple of that show, the woman went on to play Neil Simon's wife in Fosse Verdon.
Okay.
And he went on to the Pokemon movie. And it's so bizarre.
Don't judge their career path, Randy.
I loved it. I thought it was hilarious. But the whole time I'm watching it, I'm thinking...
This is messed up.
Yeah, I think it's messed up.
By
the way, I took both my kids to this, and they both, my teenager and my 12-year-old, they both loved this movie.
Yeah.
And they were not... would not have been there for, like, the big wave of Pokemon in the 90s.
No, but they both don't, I mean
as
Pokemon has lived on as a franchise.
I was going to say, as we've worked in the store, I mean, kids still play Pokemon the card game, and the video game has become
Pokemon Go has managed to ensnare just about every human being on the Earth.
Yep. True. So, I mean, Pokemon is a sort of...
Yeah, it has managed to become a thing. It's just that I think that, like, sometimes if you were there in the 90s when it happened, there's a particular level of bonding.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's a question for you guys. Would you want to see more of this? Like, more stories in Rhyme City?
I would.
Yeah.
Do you think we will?
Yes. I think it'll make enough money.
I think I saw it did not dethrone Endgame, which is its own kind
of
big beast.
Yeah, of course not.
But I think it did well. It came in second.
Okay.
Its opening week. And, I think it's a fun setting. I actually like, by removing it from the normal capture Pokemon and fight them tropes, that you manage to have the fun and cuteness of them, along with, like, some mystery. And there's actually a fair amount of seriousness in it. Yeah. Like, I almost think there might be times when a kid would be a little bored here and there.
Yeah.
But it's pretty energetic and brisk.
No one in my... all the kids in my theater
they were engaged.
Yeah, same. And okay. Sort of
there
just, like...
I guess I just figured when the main dude was, like, walking around in the rain and stuff like that.
There's still Pokemon everywhere.
It is true. There's always some Pokemon creeping around in the background.
The big barometer for me is, like, if you can get a kid to sit for... Like, it's not a short movie. It's not, like, an hour and 45 minutes.
I thought it was maybe, like, an hour and a half.
And I did not have any, like, kids getting up to go to the bathroom. I think there may have been a couple.
But you didn't see that super fidgeting that kids do?
No, there was not fidgeting. There was not, like, screaming or anything like that. It was just, they were in.
By the way, I liked the scary Apoms.
Yeah, and is that what they were called?
Greninja.
Yeah, they were like they're essentially the enforcers, the scary enforcers. Yeah.
I actually thought the subplot of the sort of primal Pokemon smoke was pretty great.
That's what I was going to say. Is Rhyme City is such a fun setting, but it does have, like, the underground Pokemon fighting because they do it like a Pokemon ring. I'm like, I love that idea. You can just have your cake and eat it too.
Yep, there were references to kind of classic Pokemon tropes, including hilariously at one point Detective Pikachu sadly sings the Pokemon theme song.
Yes. that
so
killed
good.
Me.
Yeah.
Also, Detective Pikachu trying to fight in the arena, even though that was slightly spoiled on the trailer.
Yeah. It was
still
very
was amazing. Him curling up into a ball.
The what's the name of the mime Pokemon?
Mr. Mime.
Mr. Mime?
Yeah.
Was a pretty funny scene,
yeah,
I thought. And there was some stuff that wasn't shown in the trailer, although you did see some scenes in there. Actually, now that I think about it, that actually was some of the funniest stuff, because when...
That got kind of dark a little bit.
A little bit. It's actually really messed up when you think about it, how the kid tried to make him talk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When he realizes he has to, like, work within his own pantomime mime style.
Yeah.
It's messed up.
It goes into some dark places.
I was just thinking about how that scene where they cut from it.
It's a little Pixar-ish, because they do definitely, you know, it was kids, but there's some adult stuff in there, too.
Yeah.
I mean, Ryan Reynolds can't help himself sometimes.
Yeah. That's true. favorite, just quick, favorite Pokemon that occurred in it?
Little Charmander screaming for the fights on, he was like,
the one
to
that
the
was
cage.
On the cage.
He was very excited for the fights.
I like the adorable and benign Bulbasaurs of the forest, which
cool.
Would seem like they're there to get your back when you're in trouble.
I'm all about the Psyduck.
Oh, Psyduck was great in it. The whole notion that he's almost like an anxiety-prone psychic duck who will have like a psychic detonation if he gets pushed too far.
Isn't it the Psy in his Psyduck is not just psychic, but also like...
Psycho?
Psycho or something like that. Yeah, it's like...
One of my favorite scenes is the Pikachu being a child, like... booster seat strapped in next to the Psyduck. It's like, I'm stuck next to a bomb.
That's pretty fun.
Yeah.
If I were to do if they were to do a sequel, what I would say is it'd be nice to, if they work with the same leads again, to... I think they need to kind of goose their stories to be a little bit more interesting. Mm-hmm. I think a slightly tighter script a script, a little more script doctoring, whatever it takes, a slightly better script. Would help.
Here's the trick. Without getting out of the way, they won't have a token Pokemon.
Correct.
And I think that would be a hard... That's what makes me wonder about doing a sequel.
You know what? I actually think that you can find other ways that people sort of interact with. You know, like, Ash traveled around with Pikachu in that series, and Pikachu didn't talk in it and was still a beloved character.
Yeah.
And I think you could find, like, especially if they found, like, a lesser-known Pokemon or even a new Pokemon.
Well, don't they actually outright say, like, doesn't Ryan Reynolds say that, like, we understand you based on, like, emotions and things
right,
like that?
Right, right.
Which I thought was actually very smart.
Yeah, it was a good way of reminding people that there's, like... In a way, they're a bit more than pets.
Yeah.
That they kind of have an intuitive empathy towards people. I definitely see room for improvement, but it's a good first outing. It's pretty fun.
I agree.
All right, I want to real quick talk about a couple board games I played this week, both one of which is in our demo library. So the one that isn't, I played Sushi Roll, which is the dice version of Sushi Go, which we all really love.
Yep.
You have a little conveyor belt board, you roll your dice, you choose your, instead of choosing a card, you choose a dice, you put it on your sushi thing, and then you move the conveyor belts around. So it's very much like the Sushi Go with a little bit more extra randomness, and there's reroll tokens and that kind of stuff. So I liked it. It's a different tweak. If you're enjoying the Sushi Go stuff and you like dice games, it was a good one, and we've got a few copies of that. And the other one is a game called Tiny Towns from AEG, which is a game where there's five different resources. It's like wood, stone, glass, whatever, and they're represented by little cubes. And you have different buildings you can build. Everybody has a board of like 16 squares, and you have different buildings you can build by putting a pattern. So you put like a wood, a glass, a wood, and a glass in sort of a Tetris style pattern.
Yeah. Yep.
Then you can use that to build a cottage, and the cottage is worth points at the end of the game. And then there's one that you can use to build a farm, and the farm feeds the cottages and like that. So there's like six different towns you can build, and each turn you have to, someone calls out a resource, and then everybody has to place that resource on their board. And once your resource is placed, you can't move it. Huh. So you kind of plan ahead. And it's a little bit Tetris-y. And then when it gets to be your turn, you get to call the resource so you can get something you want. And also possibly screw over other people who are trying to get other things.
Sounds kind of Settlers of Catan meets Macha Coral.
Yeah, it's not... No, it's not really that.
Okay.
It's, I mean, the closest thing I can put it is something more like... It's very Tetris-y in trying to find... It's very patchwork, which is also kind of Tetris-y. But once you place a building, it also has to stay. So you're basically sort of trying to fill your board. There's also a little bit of that Sagrada in there. You're trying to fill your board without, like, ruining all your spaces. And you're having to figure out what other people need. There's also, in this game, one of the buildings is a factory you could build, where if you built the factory, you choose one of the resources. And then whenever anybody calls that resource, you can do another resource instead. It's like a wild card thing.
What's the runtime on it, right?
It was maybe like 30, 45 minutes. And that was with learning the game.
Pretty brisk.
This could be played really quickly. It's really interesting. I did terrible. Now that I know how to play it, I'm kind of curious to play it again. It's definitely one of those games that's better for people who know how to plan ahead and do that kind of stuff. But the cards are such that you have, like, there's, like, I think six decks of four cards each, and you only use one of each type each time, so there's, like, a lot of variety.
Okay.
A lot of replayability. I really like it. Like I say, there's a copy in our demo library, so give that one a look. That's it for us this time. We'll be back with more next week. Until next time,
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.